Well, what a thrilling end to Act One of Rossini's opera William Tell. The beginnings of revolt, thrillingly brought to us by the soloists and the orchestra chorus of the Accademia Santa Cecilia from Rome, who are at the proms tonight, conducted by Antonio Papano. We end Act One, as I say, with the defiant Swiss against the Austrians. Tell has rowed the fugitive across the lake, the turbulent lake, to safety, and the Austrians have torched the village. The Swiss are in fury. William Tell is being sung tonight by Michele Pertusi, Hedwige, his wife, by Patricia Barden, Jemmy, their son, a trouser role, sung by Elena Zantudakis. Arnold Melchtal, the tenor in love with the enemy, the Habsburg princess, is being sung by John Osborne. Melchtal, his father, by Frederic Caton. Rudy by Celso Albello, Leuchtold by Mark Stone, and Rodolfo by Carlo Bossi. Well, we return shortly. There's an interval now to Act Two, and the action certainly hots up, and we get the famous incident, of course, with the apple on the head. But while everyone here is just filing out to still their heartbeats after all that at the Royal Albert Hall, this afternoon Petro Trelawney hosted a pre-concert talk with some experts to discuss the influence that Rossini's William Tell had on the grand tradition of French opera. So it's now time to go down the steps in the Royal Albert Hall and go across to the Royal College of Music.
Welcome to the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall here at the Royal College of Music, home for the next 8 weeks to Proms Plus, our nightly pre-concert events. Some will introduce repertoire, composers, artists and ensembles. Others will provide family-friendly introductions to the great works. Others still come under the banner of our Proms Plus Literary Festival. And many events, like this one, will be broadcast on BBC Radio 3. Well, with Antonio Papano's performance of Guillaume Tell across the way, we're going to consider the nationality of both the opera and its composer and look at the impact that Rossini had on the opera world in Paris. Joining me on stage, Sarah Lenton, who frequently introduces opera on Radio 3 and whose writings can be found inside the programmes of both ENO and Covent Garden, and Benjamin Walton, who's senior lecturer in music at Cambridge University and author of the book Rossini in Restoration Paris, The Sound of Modern Life. Welcome, please, Sarah Lenton and Benjamin Walton. Benjamin, Rossini was born in Pesaro, a small city on the Adriatic. He was one of the great Italian opera composers. We all know that, except perhaps the French. When he died, one of his French obituaries said, "France is where he would like to have been born."
Yes. By the time he dies in 1868, he spent a good portion of his mature years in Paris. The last 13 years of his life he spent there, and he dies in Paris. He's buried at Père Lachaise Cemetery among the great and the good, and that seems to be the end of the story, until slightly under 20 years later, in 1887, the Italian government want him back, say that he is in fact an Italian composer, dig him up. There's an official disinterring ceremony. The coffin is opened, and there are photos of Rossini's body being checked in his coffin, 20 years decomposed. And then he's put on a train back to Italy, which goes quite slowly, so there are various stops where he can be celebrated. And he ends up in Florence and is reburied as an Italian composer. Meanwhile, the French, particular French journalists, by 1887, France is a strongly nationalist country, spend a good amount of time saying exactly this sort of thing. Surely Rossini was really French.
And there was a suggestion from relatively high political levels that this was theft. I mean, we got close to a diplomatic incident over this.
Yes, and there was the sense that he'd chosen to live in Paris. He'd become a Parisian. He was such a Parisian that he was reported to only leave his apartment, beyond having a little walk around the area, twice a year to go to his summer house in Passy, just outside Paris, and then he'd come back again. And that would be his entire existence. So in some ways, anything from Italy was left a long way behind.
He first goes to France in 1823. He passes through Paris when he's on his way to come here to London. And he's received as a superstar, I think, Sarah. His reputation in Paris already is very high, thanks to Barbara Seville, Otello, Tancredi, Cenerentola.
Yes, I'm also amused by Berlioz's memoirs on the subject of Rossini, because Berlioz, as a young man, very nationalistic himself, hates Rossini. And he used to walk round the theatre of the Italians, working out how he could blow it up. So I imagine that most Parisians were in that theatre watching it and enjoying it, but there was one lone voice outside circling that theatre. But of course, the Rossini phenomenon throughout Europe was such that any major town had Rossini's operas playing. And over in London, it always took 4 years for anything to get over the channel, it seems to me. So we were always that, it's like a sort of little echo. You'd go up in London, oh my goodness, we were doing this 4 years ago in Paris, weren't we? And there it would be on in London. And he was a terrific composer, both in Paris and London.
And give us an insight into his reception here in London, because that may shed some light on how big he was
going to become
in Paris.
He was in the Opera House, not the Covent Garden Opera House then, it was the King's Theatre in Haymarket. And that was the big London theatre. That's where Verdi's Massandieri was put on. And if you start reading the newspaper reviews from the early 19th century, it's Rossini, wall-to-wall Rossini. And then other people are in, sort of nicking it and putting it on at Covent Garden in a sort of bastardised version about 2 weeks later. I've just come from Cendrillon at the Royal Opera House, and that was a Cinderella story. But it reminded me that Covent Garden put on La Cenerentola in the 1820s, about a month after the King's Theatre put on the Rossini opera, La Cenerentola. They just nicked it, made it a bit English, turned her into cinders, and Rossini turned up in another theatre. So there's this idea that Rossini is not only seen as Rossini, he's just the actual raw material for theatrical life, both in London and Paris.
So as he passes through Paris in 1823, he has various meetings which lead to, on his return the following year, him receiving an incredibly lucrative contract, a government contract.
Absolutely. I mean, even while he's in London, he's discussing with French representatives here whether he can come back to Paris and what the deal would be. And then, yes, he signs a contract, he moves back to Paris, and it's overseen by the government, it's approved by the king, and he actually goes through several contracts in the course of the few years that he's writing operas in Paris, each one more lucrative than the last one.
He starts off on 40,000 francs, is that right?
That sounds right, yes. And then he sort of, what changes too, there's the amount of money that changes, but there's also the number of years that he's going to be given that money for, which ends up being a lifetime pension, whether he writes any operas or not. And also then the bit that sort of slightly falls by the wayside are the number of operas that he's being contracted to produce, because on each occasion the contract says, right, fine, we'll pay you a lot of money, but you have to write several Italian operas and several French operas. He gets to Paris and everyone's very excited to have him there. Those operas take a while to actually start appearing, though the money, I presume, was paid anyway.
Partly, Sarah, because he says he needs a bit of time to learn how to set the French language.
I'm sure that's true. But I don't really want to go through the myths of Rossini, but of course it's very famous that Rossini was considered to be dilatory, was he not, in his writing methods?
Well, yes and no. I mean, this is someone who made his name, in a way, by working phenomenally hard, by producing opera after opera. Mm. And yes, he often left it till the last minute. And yes, the myths around him are all of him sitting around doing nothing, along the same lines as happens with other composers. I would say by the time he gets to Paris, yes, possibly he doesn't want to produce at the same rate. Whether that counts as laziness or just exhaustion is a different matter.
We should explain the political world that he enters in Paris. As he was finishing Il Terzo in Italia in 1814, the Restoration had taken place. The House of Bourbon was back in charge. So when he arrived in Paris, it was home to a monarchy, and this suited Rossini very well indeed.
Yes, there's a funny tension that I think we'll probably come on to talk about in terms of works like William Tell. being seen as the 19th century goes on, particularly as a revolutionary work, and politically revolutionary as well as musically revolutionary. In many ways, though, Rossini is an absolute establishment figure. He's being appointed by the government. He's most successful. I mean, the desire to have him in Paris comes from his success at the Italian Theatre, which is the theatre for the aristocracy. So in that sense, there's nothing revolutionary there at all.
And is he a sort of court composer? I mean, is he that close to the establishment?
Yes, and he seems to... I mean, there are enough people who are against him and against the amount of power that he has for him to need a certain amount of protection from within government to make sure that he can do what he needs to do. I think he was always... He was an extremely canny man, and he could work out who he needed most at a particular time. That is, he never was a sort of court pet, because he would never let himself get in that position. And also, he was too famous. I mean, remember, one of the famous things when he comes to London is that he meets George IV, and that's presented as two monarchs meeting, the musical monarch and the monarch of England. So, in a way, he's a court composer, but of the very highest kind.
We should just go through his Paris operas quite quickly, I think. Il Viaggio is the first one, written in Italian, and effectively an entertainment for the coronation of Charles X.
He gets to Paris. Louis XVIII is in power, but dies very shortly after Rossini arrives. And so, yes, his first work is for the coronation of Louis XVIII's brother, the last Bourbon monarch in France, Charles X, and is only done three times and then a fourth charity performance. But it's done as a sort of piece to celebrate the coronation and then disappears.
He then goes on to write two operas that were effectively adaptations of pieces he'd already written.
Yes, Moses, which is a very early piece, and which was obviously Italian, done in Italy, and then The Siege of Corinth. And then, wonderfully, he adapts the music of Viaggio for Le Comte Henri, which is, I think, one of the pearls of the Rossini repertory, most wonderful opera.
And then we get to the final opera, William Tell. We mentioned his ever-increasing financial remuneration. He used William Tell as a sort of bargaining tool, didn't he, to secure a lifelong pension?
Yes, William Tell is a long time coming, and in fact, when Le Comte Henri appears, that already in the summer of 1828, there already have been rumours around for almost a year that he's going to produce William Tell. Henri appears, which is a fabulous piece, but a small piece. And I think within that context, everyone's been sitting around waiting for this piece, waiting and waiting and waiting. There are lots of reasons for the delays. But meanwhile, at a certain point, Rossini is renegotiating his contract and asks for a pension forever, regardless of whether he's going to write any more operas. The government stalls, and then he points out, I haven't given you Acts 3 and 4 yet. You can't have William Tell unless we bargain in a little bit more of a friendly manner. And so, yes, in a way, he holds the French government hostage, which needs this great piece to appear, and so he gets what he wants.
We always talk about William Tell and prefix it with the words revolutionary opera. I mean, it's been done in the Proms Guide. It's done on the liner notes for the new recording by Antonio Pappano. It seems to be the easiest, but perhaps the laziest way of introducing the work. It is revolutionary, but of course it's dangerous to think that it's about necessarily the French Revolution, because it opens a year before the revolution. The king is still on the throne when it opens.
It's a safe revolution. It's all about a Swiss hero and the Swiss being safe republicans. Everybody admired the Swiss in the 18th century. They were sturdy chaps who drank from the mountain stream and ate goat's cheese and had sort of meetings on the village green. They were like the noble savage, only in the middle of Europe. Nobody noticed the fleas or the idiocy and all the inbreeding problems of Switzerland. They just noticed the noble savage. So there you are. So these noble Swiss. And they were perfectly safe. They didn't do guillotines or anything like that. They just had sort of meetings on the village green. And William Tell comes with all those charming legends, which are all in the opera. And in many ways, it's a picturesque opera with this noble chap. But all he wants to do is he wants to get back to a very conservative Swiss way of life, which is the village green stuff, He wants to be a good peasant, he wants to get on with his family, and he wants to get rid of the Austrians. I think the French have no problem with any of that. The idea that it would actually spark off a revolution in the boulevards, I think it's very, very remote. I don't think anybody was worried about that.
So you could see this as a revolutionary opera or not a revolutionary opera, depending on which viewpoint you came from.
Yes, and I think in a way that's the fascinating thing about it, that on the one hand, in the 1820s in Paris, you have people who are not allowed to talk about political revolution too much, but who talk about revolution in other ways absolutely obsessively. So they talk about the history of other revolutions, and Tell is a good example of that. So yeah, on the one hand, it is revolutionary, and because it shows a revolution on stage, and so does the Siege of Corinth, that someone, a group of people rising up against another people, so is Moses. In that sense, it's absolutely the common currency, and it's revolutionary if you're longing for that. If you want to sit in the hall and you want to see that, then you get that. But I absolutely agree. It's also a very safe, contained sort of revolution, and a revolution that could get past the censors and could be seen as just a return to the natural order. So you could take from it what you wanted to.
The play by Schiller that it's based on was hugely popular in Paris in the years running up to the opera, wasn't it? I think there were five or six stagings at one point in 1828, running simultaneously.
Well, there's a moment when everyone knows Rossini is going to produce William Tell. They even know that it might be his last opera. That's rumoured from very early on, too. And as a result, there's this sort of epidemic of Tells in Paris. And in the summer of 1828, you could see several on one night. Some based on Schiller, others based on other tellings of the story and done as melodrama or done as vaudeville or done as English theatre. The English theatre that Harriet Smithson belonged to appeared at the Italian theatre, in fact, the opera theatre, to perform a version of Tell as well. So yes, by the time you get to Rossini's Tell, a lot of the reviews say, we all know this story, we don't need to go into this. And some even say, we've known this story since we were children. You know, we get fed it as a bedtime story, and then we've seen it in all these different versions. No one needs to know what the story of Tell is.
So it was the obvious tale for Rossini to set. How revolutionary was his approach to making it into an opera?
It's difficult to see Tell because we see it through the lens of fairly revolutionary shows, especially the ones associated with Verdi. Not that he was in a position in Italy, this is Verdi of course, to produce extremely rebellious operas, but we all know that a lot of Verdi's shows were code operas, so that you'd look at oppressed Hebrews and think, that's us, and then you'd look at wicked Babylonians and think, yeah, that's Austrian, isn't it? And then as you get used to that sort of show, you get used to the tenor hero who will use the word la patria as, you know, the big word, and amore is really quite in the wings there. So if the poor girl gets between him and la patria, his country, she's going to be put aside. And, with my sort of Verdian eyes, I look at Tell and I think, good Lord, the tenor, and definitely a tenor, how many top C's is it?
It's a good number. James Joyce counted them once. There's a letter from James Joyce where he goes through the entire part of Tell, counting all the high notes.
Didn't he have a protégé who sang?
He did. Yes. Yeah.
Something like 15, I think. Anyway, he's in love with a girl from an Austrian girl, and unlike most Risorgimento heroes, he doesn't say, "Oh well, bye, darling, we've got a revolution to do." He says, "Oh, better join the Austrian army then." And it takes the murder of his father to get him over onto the Swiss side. I mean, this might be Italian Revolution, but it's not as you know it, Jim, really. It's so much earlier.
Although then when the piece gets done in other cities in the 1830s and into the 1840s, it frequently gets changed absolutely, so because the political resonances are there if you want to find them. Oh. So when it gets done in Milan, it gets done as Robert the Bruce versus Edward the First, and it all gets moved to Scotland, which is seen as safer than Switzerland, and there are no Austrians involved, so it's okay. It's far enough north that no one need feel too threatened.
How did they do the apple scene?
they used a potato.
It used a chorus in a way that the chorus had never quite been integrated in the same way and given as much dramatic importance in opera, had it?
This is thought to give it its grand opera credentials, that you have a big chorus. And grand opera is a strange sort of term. I'm often asked, is Aida a grand opera? And I never know quite what to say. Well, it's certainly got the triumphal march. William Tell is apparently a grand opera, and I think the definition is notionally, well, it's notionally that it's by Meyerbeer, but of course this can't be true of William Tell. You've got chorus and you've got big tableaus at the end of a show, and it goes on a long time. And so in that way, you can say it's a grand opera, especially with these wonderful choruses integral to the piece. They give you the whole sense of the Swiss community. And actually, I think part of the emotional centre of this, especially when the cantons come on stage, you know, Uri and Unterwalden and Schweiss. There's a moment where you think, how many cantons are there? But, you know, in they come. I think this is an astonishing way of writing for Rossini. And I would actually wonder, though, whether the show was a comic opera. Can I offer that to you?
Which has been argued by several people, hasn't
Richard
it?
Richard Osborne in Grove's Dictionary says, actually, it's comic. Comic doesn't have to mean funny. And I think he means that it's family values. It comes to a harmonious conclusion. They're, by definition, not noble people on stage. They're Swiss peasants. So we're already in the sort of area where comedy works, and we're deeply interested in the lives of ordinary people, which come to a very satisfying resolution, and we hear the wonderful sound of the cow horn, isn't it? The shepherd's call off stage, which becomes an ode to liberty at the end. And there's a lot of mileage in thinking of it as a comic opera rather than as a huge grand opera, perhaps.
How much influence did it have on the future direction of French music? 1829, when it's premiered, has been described as a watershed in French music. One musicologist wrote, the year stands as a symbol of the birth of musical romanticism in France. Do French music lovers have William Tell and Rossini in part to thank for that? I mean, that takes us back to what we were saying earlier on about Berlioz, I suppose, and his hatred of Rossini, but love of William Tell.
Yes and no. I mean, I think I would say yes, they absolutely do, but lots of people thinking about 19th century French music forget that Rossini is this big part of it, because you can wrap 1829 up with 1830, it becomes close enough, but people often will look to Berlioz or will look to later grand operas of Meyerbeer or Halévy, and I think Guillaume Tell has an absolutely fundamental role in shaping the way that people think of musical drama throughout the 19th century in France, but you don't get enough chances to hear it in order to be able to find out how that works.
Do you think it had a huge influence on what was to happen in French opera, Sarah?
I'm very interested in the part of the high tenor in this show. He has got all these top C's. I was talking to Ben beforehand as to how on earth he sung them, because Rossini is part of the bel canto Italian tradition. He disliked the natural male voice going that high, and it's quite difficult to know how his tenors got these very high notes he gave them. It seems that they went into their falsetto voice very, very cleverly, and there is the famous occasion where some tenor comes to visit Rossini, who's got a natural top C, and Rossini says, oh yes, Monsieur so-and-so, tell him to leave his top C on the hat stand, would you? And then he writes this part for with all these top C's in it, and later when the show is revived, there certainly is a tenor who's singing them in the natural way. And to me, William Tell is a strange hybrid. I keep finding that it's not quite a Risorgimento show, it's not quite a comedy, it's got a heroic tenor in it, but how did that heroic tenor sing under Rossini's baton? So I don't think I've got a very clear answer on where Tell sits.
And clearly casting is one of the reasons why it's not done very often, but it is fascinating how rarely it's heard. A century elapsed between Covent Garden's two productions. They did it in 1990, hadn't been done for 100 years. They did it once, they revived it once. It's gone again.
Buster. Yeah.
Why?
very difficult to stage. You've got to cast it. And it's got all sorts of little problems in it. It's fine if you do it naturalistically, which is what the 1990 production was, though that didn't mean it didn't escape a certain amount of critical flack. But you see, you do have, the moment you think of it as a show, you've got the problem of Tell has got to be in a boat rescuing someone on a choppy sea. So there's the first little problem. And on the first night, this was very apparently a problem because the boat stuck. And he walked across the water. Then, of course, you have the apple scene and the crossbow. And Jemmy's one side of the stage, his son tells the other, and you always notice with some horror that they're putting an extremely large apple on Jemmy's head. And you think, my God, he's not actually going to shoot that thing, is he? And as it is dead, I can safely tell you that we still have the practical crossbow at Covent Garden when the bolt is swallowed by the crossbow, and it's a very emphatic gesture by Tell as he apparently shoots the crossbow. So everybody looks at him, doesn't notice that Jemmy's sliding his upstage hand down the tree, and as the bolt flies across the stage, which of course it isn't doing at all because it's swallowed by the crossbow, Jemmy presses a button on the tree, and a concealed bolt in the apple, you guessed this, didn't you, goes doi oi 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 in the apple. This again is fraught with problems, as you can imagine. And then, if that wasn't enough, in the last act, you have that fantastic melodramatic device, the fatal abyss, which you've usually, there's a plank joining two Alps together. That's if a heroine is going across. But if you're a chap, you don't get the plank, you have to leap. So you've got to do the fatal abyss and you've got to do the heroic leap. And all these things mitigate against a successful production.
You will be thrown out of whatever the musical equivalent of the Magician's Circle is, I think, sharing that with us. It's been a very interesting insight into the work that we're hearing at the Proms this evening. Sarah Lenton and Benjamin Walton, thank you both very much indeed.
That was Petroc Trelawney earlier this afternoon at the Royal College of Music, talking to Sarah Lenton and Benjamin Walton. Sarah, of course, is with me at the box here at the Royal Albert Hall this evening. By the magic of radio, we're just finishing the first interval to William Tell, and very exciting it has been. Just give you the cast list for Act Two before we go any further, because the stage is filling up. William Tell is sung by Michael Partusi, Hedwig, his wife, by the mezzo Patricia Barden, Matilda, who we meet for the first time in this act, the princess from the enemy side, Malin Burström. Arnold Melchtar is John Osborne, king of the high seas. Melchtar, his father, Frederick Caton. Walter Furst is Matthew Rose, and the huntsman is Davide Malfestio, who comes out from the chorus. And of course, it's the orchestra and chorus of the renowned Academy of Santa Cecilia in Rome, conducted by Antonio Papano. We'll find out more about them in the second interval. Well, at the end of Act One, we left the village of Bergler in flames, the occupying Austrians enraged at the escape of a Swiss shepherd who'd killed one of their men, and indeed at the man who'd rowed him across the lake to safety, William Tell. In Act Two, it's dusk. We're in a deeply forested valley overlooking Lake Lucerne. Swiss shepherds tending their flocks, Austrians celebrating a successful raid. Princess Matilda singing of her loneliness, the ravishing aria Sombre Forêt. Arnold appears. Despite their impossible differences of rank and loyalty, they swear their love. Then Tell sees them and accuses Arnold of treachery. Arnold says he'll leave to seek his fortune and the chance of Matilda's hand, but then he's told that the Austrians have killed his father. All changes, all unite, including the men of the three cantons. They will fight and resist their unjust masters. And out goes the call to arms. Well, Sarah Lenton, as I said, is still with me. It's thrilling stuff, and we're getting such colour and dynamics in the Academy of Santa Cecilia, aren't we?
I can't believe they're doing this. It's the energy at the end there. I saw the village go up in flames. It doesn't matter whether we're staged or not. And then, in the middle of that act, the tiniest ting on a triangle. I mean, one had to really look to see whether he was pinging it or not.
Yes, I'm sort of totally agog at this. We knew it was going to be wonderful. At one point, of course, I know you were talking to Petrarch earlier about Rossini in Paris. He was the toast of Paris. This was a French commission, so presumably that's why it's in French. There was never any question of it being in Italian, was there?
No, I mean, he did do a few shows in Paris in Italian, but I think he was just getting his hand in. I think what we hear in this opera is him reacting to the wonderful French orchestra he had to hand. Mm. And I think the French orchestra always raises the game for Italian composers. I remember Donizetti suddenly reacts to using a French La Fille du Régiment, for
Indeed.
Example.
Indeed. Well, yes. Actually, I was thinking of La Fille du Régiment because I don't know whether there are
the
more...
Alps.
The Alps. Yes, but also whether there are more, the tenor is more high C's in Donizetti's La Fille du Régiment or in William Tell, because he's got quite a lot.
15, I believe.
15. I heard you earlier saying, or Ben actually, saying that James Joyce had counted them.
Golly.
Apparently it's 15. I'm sure someone will keep us right and tell us. And the other great thrill, of course, is the rising central position of the chorus. This is really Rossini giving a voice to the people, the ordinary Swiss people, because it's very much about them.
And Rossini I've never heard, except from Moses. Moses, oh, yeah. He has such a big chorus. It's wonderful. And just here at the Albert Hall, to hear the horn calls coming from all bits of the hall. Mm. I mean... The choir seemed to take up about a third of the stage here, but then there's obviously brass all around us. It's the most thrilling event.
Isn't it? Well, someone said beforehand, the thing is, Act 1, there's not a great deal happens. Things really get going in acts 2, 3 and 4. I don't think I can take any more tension.
I'm crazed.
We're here to raise the baton and probably raise the temperature as well. Act 2 of William Tell is Antonio Pappano. Thank you.
fanno. Se l'odre ne pur, chi l'ordone passi la nì.
Passi la nì.
Passi la nì.
Passi la
nì. Del cor sonne, del cor sonne, passi la nì. Passi la nì. Passi la nì. Passi la nì.
souffrir un passage.
Thank you. tiens.
Je ne m'informe pas de vos desseins.
Peut-être plus qu'un autre, dois-tu chercher à les connaître? Ah, qu'importe avec tal, s'il déserte nos rangs. Si l'aspire en secret à servir nos tyrans.
Qui te l'a dit?
Ton trouble et Mathilde sa fuite.
On m'écrit, et c'est toi!
Toi-même! Ta conduite hier jeta les soupçons dans ce cœur alarmé.
Mais si j'aime.
Grand Dieu!
Mais si je suis aimé, tes soupçons.
Sera vrai!
Mon amour
est impie.
Mathilde!
Elle est notre ennemie! Parmi nos oppresseurs, elle a reçu la vie. Humilcta lâchement. Embrasse ce genou.
Mais de quel droit votre aveugle furie?
Nos droits, un mot te les apprendra tous. Sais-tu bien ce que c'est que d'aimer sa patrie?
Vous parlez de patrie? Il n'en est plus pour nous. Je quitte ce rivage. Qu'habite la discorde et la haine et la peur, digne fille de l'esclavage. Je cours dans les combats, reconquérir l'honneur.
à la fois ton père et ton pays.
Achève-le !
La nuit, à nos desseins propices, nous entoure déjà d'une ombre protectrice. Tu vas voir dans ces lieux que Gessler croit soumis surgir de tous côtés de généreux amis. Ils comprendront tes larmes au soc de la charrue. Ils empruntent des armes pour conquérir un digne sort.
Thank you.
pas nombreux la forêt retentir.
Le bruit approche.
Qui s'avance? Au bonheur!
Au vengeance!
Honneur!
Honneur à leur présence!
Wald, ô vous généreux fils, ce noble empressement n'a rien qui nous étonne,
que sera limité. De nos frères de Schwitz, chantons la trompe qui résonne. Tes enfants soient fiers, ô mon pays.
Thank you. pardonne la crête à de si grands malheurs. Mais croyez-en mon espérance, leur cœur répondront à nos cœurs.
Du seul canton du Rhin, nous regrettons l'absence.
Pour dérober la trace de leur pas, pour mieux cacher nos saintes trames, nos frères sur les eaux s'ouvrent avec leur âme un chemin qui ne trahit pas.
Le prince est fait, la promesse est suivie. N'entends-tu pas?
Qui vient?
Amis de la patrie, amis de la patrie.
Un signal d'alarme,
de victoire.
Quel cri doit-il répondre?
Aux armes!
Aux armes!
End of Act Two of Rossini's opera William Tell, with all the Swiss cantons rised to arms against the Austrian oppressors. Such a stirring account of it here, live from the Royal Albert Hall, from the orchestra and chorus of the Academy of the Chianti Cecilia and the soloist. I feel a bit like cheering myself. Antonio Pappano marshalling his forces. We've still got the great apple contest to come. William Tell has been sung tonight by Michele Pertusi, Hedwig, his wife, by Patricia Barden, Matilda, the princess, by Marlon Bostrom, Arnold Melchior, the tenor lover, by John Osborne, Melchtual, by Frederick Caton, Walter Fürst by Matthew Rose, and The Huntsman was sung by Davide Malvestio. And as we said, it's a Roman invasion from the orchestra and chorus of the Accademia di Santa Cecilia under Antonio Pappano. Well, Sarah Lenton is with me in the box. We'll find out just in a moment or two about the sound of the Academy and also the long history of it. I've been talking to Antonio Pappano shortly, but impression so far, Sarah, we were bowled over at the end of Act 1. It's just got better and better, hasn't
it? This is a new Rossini, isn't it? It's got a brooding resentment and a somberness. One expected the happy peasants, but I wasn't expecting these incredibly virile cantons to appear.
Yeah.
It just goes to show that if you gave Rossini the resources, he rose to them.
Well, this is very interesting, but why do you think he rose to this huge effort at the end of his life? Not the end of his operatic life, he was only 37, for goodness sake, but he had to be pushed into doing this, and it was eagerly awaited. And then he said, that's it, I really am not writing any more opera. Did he realise that he'd poured all his soul into this?
Well, he'd been writing since he was 13. He'd written a phenomenal amount. I mean, there is just a chance he burnt out at 37. Yeah. It's a dangerous age for a composer, if we think of Bizet and Mendelssohn and Mozart and Purcell.
Well, some of them died, mind you. So.
Yeah. Well, Rossini obviously realised that it was a dangerous age and retired. No, I think there must be an element of exhaustion in Rossini. But to go out like this...
This is a blaze, isn't it? This is a real blaze. Well, we've already said the interesting thing of revolution, but a safe revolution, because it's in Switzerland. And was at that time, certainly was everyone's idea of a romantic perfection with the glaciers and the happy peasants and the wonderful, wonderful scenery.
Yes, as long as you didn't get out of your carriage.
Ah.
Once you got out of your carriage, it was another story. And I think everybody was right, though, about the toughness of the Swiss. We all know they have crossbow. But actually, if you look at a Swiss guard to this day in the Vatican, he's got a halberd. Now, that was an incredibly feared weapon because it outreached a sword if you were fighting. And this is from the time of Tell. And in the hands of a Swiss, the halberd could get to the mounted knight and jack him out of his horse.
Oh.
And actually, a halberd is something used for haymaking. So you're talking someone very tough who's using this thing, but someone who's a peasant. And astonishingly, Rossini's given us that toughness and that peasant quality.
Hasn't he just? And just even those cantons coming together, even the name roll call, Unterwalter and Schwitz and Uri, all coming together, it sends shivers down the spine.
Oh, if you go through Switzerland to this day, you're now entering the canton of Uri, and you think, gosh, you know, these are the guys who were part of the original confederation.
Indeed. Well, a lot more guts there. It's not all just perfect cleanliness and the clocks working.
I did notice a whole staging problem there. I discovered, as I was reading the libretto, that the whole of the Uri canton come across on boats.
Yes.
That would be a worry if one was a stage manager.
Well, I think it's something... I think this is going to come back to the stage. This has been such a sensation tonight. I wouldn't be at all surprised if we see it here in a year or two. Well, Sarah, come back to you, but I think a word from the man himself, Antonio Pappano, has been quite rightly absolutely passionate about this opera and about Rossini, and he has certainly made an extraordinary difference to the Academy of Santa Cecilia in Rome. Now, it's very ancient. It goes right back to the time of Palestrina. He was a member. That's extraordinary. So was Rossini. The orchestra, of course, much more recent. But I wondered if the orchestra itself, which is sounding so marvellous, is it different to a British sound, did he think? What's the particular sound?
It's an interesting question because one tends to think of the Italian sound as being sun-washed and Mediterranean and full of song, and it is. But this orchestra also has somehow an innate sense of how to play Rossini. And Rossini makes many demands on the orchestra in terms of precision and electricity and ensemble, of course, just to get back to basics. And they seem to have a natural approach to the virtuosity of the thing.
Is it very different to the British sound? Is the attitude to making music very different?
I think it is. You know, even though a lot of my orchestra has not played that much opera, because it's, you know, it's a symphonic orchestra, and there are a lot of young people in the orchestra, in their souls, they're operatic beings somehow. All Italians come from that. So the idea of singing on the instrument is something that is so profoundly inside them. But also the innate sense of show business of, you know, look, this is what I can do, you know, showing. Whether it's different from the English approach, I'm not so sure. I mean, I have, you know, I work with my opera orchestra here at Covent Garden, which is an extremely flexible instrument. You know, they're very chameleon-like. They can reinvent themselves on the spot depending on what the piece is. My orchestra in Rome is more something fixed, which I also have to mold, but it's a symphonic outfit. So yeah. I'm trying to get Covent Garden to be more symphonic, and I'm trying to get Rome to be more operatic.
Well, I mean, they both come together, certainly in your orchestra in Rome, in the huge choral works you've chosen to record, like the Verdi Requiem.
Yes.
It's all there, isn't it?
Of course. Again, with this natural desire to sing, the fact that I have this wonderful chorus on top of it, fantastically disciplined chorus, but also with a imposing sound. They have this huge, chunky, operatic sound, and yet they're able to file it down and create the most delicate atmospheres with their singing, getting the action of the language across. It's a unique sound.
We forget how ancient an institution this academy is. I mean, you go right back to...
It goes back to Palestrina. I mean, the orchestra, of course, not. I mean, it's just over 100 years old. But the organization as such, back to Palestrina. It's amazing.
So what do you see as the tradition that you're carrying on with this orchestra?
Well, what I'm trying to do is trying to keep this orchestra Italian. You know, it's very easy in this orchestral world that all orchestras sound the same. All very professional, very, very good, and all, you know, technically smart and all that. But I somehow want to keep the personality of this orchestra intact. If I can do that, to show off their Italianità, I think it's very, very important.
Music from Respighi's The Pines of Rome, Antonio Pappano conducting his orchestra of the Accademia di Santa Cecilia in Rome. And of course, they are the forces who are here live at the Royal Albert Hall tonight on the stage to give us Rossini's last great masterpiece, William Tell. And they are certainly wowing the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall, whether it's with l'Italianità or whatever. It's very, very special indeed. Well, the audience right having a little moment of relaxation before they come back to join Tell for the final assault against the Austrians. But before that, here's Edward Seckerson leaning over the edge of my box. Edward Seckerson from The Independent. Very nice to have you leaning lightly. What do you think so far?
Well, it's started cooking nicely, hasn't it? You really feel with the couple of performances they've given so far that it's now under the fingers and in the voices.
Yeah.
I think what's so amazing about hearing Italians perform this music, even though it's written in French, is the lightness of the articulation. I mean, absolutely, the articulation is everything, isn't it?
I mean, I've been leaning out of this box and just looking around because the filigree element of it is extraordinary. I mean, obviously, there's the excitement of the choruses and the band, amazing. But your sense of ensemble is marvellous.
And of course, the piece, which is makes such advances on what Rossini had written until that point. And we heard in the trio of that last act, that extraordinary trio, I mean, it's Verdi. I mean, Verdi is foreshadowed. Yes. There's a lot of that in the piece.
Well, as Antonio Pappano said, you know, my goodness, I didn't realise, he said, till I listened to William Tell, that he invented Verdi. It's all there. It's all presaging Verdi and onwards.
Yeah, you think you know Rossini, but when you hear this piece, there are lots of surprises. And there are three big stonking numbers to come in Act 3.
Oh, good. Yes. Don't go away, therefore. Don't go anywhere. The excitement is almost impossible. Well, we're only on day two of the proms. I was here last night. We had In Tune Live in the Royal College of Music, and I rushed up and managed to hear Benjamin Grosvenor. The sensation of the time, really. First, I think, British pianist to be signed to Decca in 60 years. He's only 19, and he was fabulous. And then Janáček's amazing Glagolitic Mass. We've got an even bigger one to come tomorrow. Are you going to attempt to squeeze in someone beside, if there's any room left after the performers?
Less is certainly not more tomorrow. More is more and more. I'm actually never heard the Gothic Symphony live.
This is Havergal Brian.
Yes.
And you'll know his name after tomorrow if you listen.
I think we will. I mean, it's going to be an extraordinary event, and I think one just has to be here. I've heard the piece before on disc, and I don't know what to make of it. I mean, there are obvious parallels to be drawn with Mahler 8, with his... the Goethe-Faust element, and both composers find redemption from Faust in big choral music. I mean, Havergal Brian goes for broke with the longest setting of the Te Deum in the history of music.
Yeah. Well, there's going to be, 1,200 performers here. They'll have to extend the Royal Albert Hall stage. The stalls at the side have got an orchestra each, and there are four offstage bands. So that's all to come tomorrow. Other excitement, of course, Jerzy Bielak-Klawek, doing a lot of Czech music with the BBC Symphony Orchestra this year, which is, if Rossini is in Papano's soul, Czech music is in his soul, isn't
Absolutely. It? Absolutely, and he's Mavlast on Friday.
Yeah.
The Czechs have a way with that piece. They understand that it's not all wonderfully exemplarily scored, and again, it's the lighter touch, plenty of air in the texture, and they make it so personal. It is so personal and so special for them, that piece. So, and also playing the Dvorak, Jean-Guillaume Keras, who I think is an exciting young cellist, so that should be interesting. But I suppose
he's coming into play for us on Monday. So
oh, is he?
Yes, you get a little preview of just himself and his cello.
Okay, well, I think probably for me the highlight of the week will be Mark Elder's concert with the Halle. Mm. It's the one I'm looking forward to most. I think he's done extraordinary work with this orchestra over the last couple of years, and it's a typical Elder programme. You know, Sibelius first half with a lighter and less known piece of Sibelius coupled with the searching Seventh Symphony. And then András Schiff, that patrician among pianists, playing the Bartók Third Concerto. Nostalgic, wistful piece written in exile. And another big work for the hall, Janáček's Sinfonietta. Mm. 12 trumpets and
fantastic.
A lot else besides.
So joyful,
fantastic,
isn't it?
Yeah, yes.
Marvellous. Well, so much, and I hope you'll keep taking the vitamin pills right
will.
To the end of the season. There's so much to celebrate. It is extraordinary to see this hall filled. It is marvellous. Tomorrow, of course, the Havergal Brian Gothic Symphony. Just look at the forces involved in that. I suppose you wouldn't get this anywhere else, would you?
No, and I was just thinking we've got a couple of star cellists this week. You wouldn't get that anywhere else either. The Capucin brothers, Gautier and... His brother, what is his name? His
Renaud,
Christian name? Renaud. Yeah, absolutely.
Like
sibling symbiosis.
They're wonderful. Ed, thank you very much indeed. Just a few things to keep your eye and your ear across. Ed Zekerson, thank you very much indeed. Well, as far as the Gothic Extravaganza is concerned tomorrow night, it is absolutely vast, as we said. We caught up with some of the people involved, members of the Brighton Festival Chorus and the person charged with the organisation of it all for the BBC Proms, Sarah Pantcheff.
It's just been mad. There's so many people and it's chaos. Organised chaos, I hope, but chaos nonetheless.
Have you any idea how many people there are?
We've got around about 600 in the adult choruses, about 160 in the children's choruses, and something in the region of 250 in the orchestra.
Have you ever dealt with anything like this before?
No. And I hope maybe not again for a while.
There's not going to be much room, certainly even in rehearsal, for anybody else on stage once they're all squeezed on. Have those heavenly twins of health and safety been beaming down at you at all?
Oh, yes. Yes, I've been risk assessing, like, my life depends on it. We've had extra staging built to fit everyone on the stage. We've had to take out seats in the stalls to get the offstage bands in. It's one of those wonderful things that the Proms is so good at. You know, there's not that many other arenas that you could do something like this. And I love the sense of, let's go for it, let's do this piece that is hard work for everybody.
I'm James Morgan, I'm the music director of Brighton Festival Chorus, and I've been with the choir now for 10 years. It's a massive challenge to put something like this together. It's the sheer size of it. I mean, it's never done for that very reason. And I guess the Proms is one of the few organisations in the world that could put this piece on. It'll be a great day. I mean, I've been involved in Proms in the past, but nothing quite like this. It's really very, very tricky indeed. The absence of any key signatures particularly. It's nearly got a tune in every bar, but it then wanders off in a different direction every time. Just as the chorus think they've got a hold on the tonality, it shifts again.
My name's Wayne Jones. I've been in the choir for 36 years. I joined when I was 18. I came to the University of Sussex. And I've been in the choir ever since. It's tricky work to learn in isolation because of the number of choruses involved. The score we've got has only just got half the chorus writings in it. And we're obviously one of a large number of choruses. And until we get the whole piece played as an ensemble, it'll be very difficult to piece the thing together.
I think that's going to be the biggest challenge, actually, to come together for the first time. I think that could be quite intimidating for all the choirs, in fact, to suddenly discover there's an enormous amount of other music going on around them and to try not to be put off. It's almost the opposite of what I'm constantly telling the choir to do, which is to listen. And quite a lot of the time I'm going to be telling them not to listen. It's fantastic for the chorus to be coming to the Proms again. It's the first time we've been for a while, so it's lovely to be back.
You can hear the Brighton Festival Chorus. Actually, there are 10 choirs in all. There are 4 offstage bands and 2 orchestras, all assembled by Sarah Panchev for the BBC Brahms for Havergal Brian's Gothic Symphony. It's tomorrow night here live from the Royal Albert Hall starting at 7 o'clock. Well, that's where we are. It's just a little stream of people coming in for the ending of the stupendous account of Rossini's opera William Tell from the Accademia di Santa Cecilia in Rome. But there's something new this year in the Proms. Once a week after the main Prom concert, the newly refurbished Elgar Room, complete with bar, Promers will have the chance to sample the work of up-and-coming jazz musicians from the UK's conservatories and also the work of the brightest young poets. Well, last night, the Elgar Rooms were pretty packed, and to entertain them for an hour of late-night poetry and jazz, there were the Will Gibson Band and Laura Dockrell.
Is anyone here a dad? What? Yeah, there's only 3 dads. No, there's more dads. Some of you just itching your necks, which means you're dads. Oh, granddads. Sorry, you've been promoted. Fantastic. Okay, well, this poem's Sunday. It's from the dad's perspective. Sunday is my day, there's no day like Sunday. From Monday to Saturday are just blue days without you. And my heart cracks to see you're back. I'm no dad until you're back. It's Sunday and that's my day with you. Last night I left my mates in the pub. What? But tomorrow Sunday they call after me. Well, exactly, I say, and stop off to buy full fat milk. I clean the house, I pump the cushions, I shave, I get an early night. I wonder if the nerves will ever wear off. I wonder if I'll ever not love the feeling of having you at my place. Will it wear off? It is Sunday. My day, with you all to myself day. I pick you up from her at Victoria, as always, by the Marks and Spencers. Pick you up to get a better look. You are big, and I'm so drunk and clumsy on love that I kiss you everywhere and you wipe your cheek, but I don't mind still carrying me through to the platform as we dodge and duck through cross society. I don't care who I upset to make sure Mikey gets a seat. You know, you're my boy. Your plastic action man rucksacks, it's on my forearm. The stickiness with the sweat draws the hairs out of my arm. A sticky, sooky slip has developed. I think about what I would do if I had money. I think about chucking us on an aeroplane, the two of us kicking back, yakking about all the football play when we get to the beach and how it all screwed up. You're only six. How's school? I ask. What a stupid question. I smash my head to distract you from the bad taste that instigate a play fight with you. We tussle like a cub and his bear, my fists plunging down like spongy water bombs as they explode, and I realise I did this just as an excuse to be near to you. Dad, what's this? You have one of those free papers open to impress me. It's a picture of drought, of dying land. I want to say that's how I feel. That is my heart and my lungs when you are not with me. You are my rain. But instead I say, this is what happens when the earth gets thirsty. And I don't recognise the shoes you're wearing. I want to ask you about them, but I'm afraid I won't like the answer. I want to compliment your shoes. I want to say nice things about his shoes, but my lips won't fold into the right places. And my son chose the lines of the words in the paper. I love this paper, he adds. He's a good actor. I think about performing for you the werewolf impression you told me to master. In your words, you said, yeah, your werewolf impression is good. It's just not as good as Mr. Henderson's, your stupid, cool, annoying teacher who drives a Lambretta and says the word sick. You add, I hope your impression gets better than Mr. Henderson's as well, actually, though. And I say, oh, it will, boy. It will. And it has, actually. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. For the rest of the day, I let you do what you want. You have two chocolate croissants for your breakfast and a bag of Snobby's nuts and a Coke in the pub you like with the playground. And you climb, and you climb, and you climb, and I sit staring into space. We'll get takeaway tonight, and I hope I can guess what you want before you tell me, and I hope I get it right. I hope he wants to sleep in the bed with me like last time. He's so small, and I can't stand the thought of him being alone. I watch you struggle on a set of monkey bars and want to help you, but I know I mustn't, so I sit. Hoping you like The Clash. Hoping you like meat and beer. Hoping you like me.
the Will Gibson Band having a little late night chill after last night's prom, and young jazzers from the conservatories and young poets. Great to see it. Once a week here after the main prom. The next one will be on Friday. Don't forget, of course, there's Radio 3, home of the proms. During the proms, you can do a podcast from Breakfast, from In Tune, from Composer of the Week, from Classical Collection, and there's Proms Online Interactive, so it's worth checking it all out because there's really an extraordinary amount going on. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the final two acts, the denouement of Rossini's unexpected in places and absolutely thrilling final opera, William Tell. So we're in the Swiss cantons, a nice sort of deliciously simple revolution. Arnold, who's joined the revolutionary forces, and his Princess Mathilde kneel in Rouen Chapel, but with his father killed and revolt on the way, they realise their love really is impossible. Then we move to the main square in Altdorf, where the Austrians are celebrating 100 years of their rule. The governor, Gessler, wants the people to bow to his hat as a symbol of imperial authority. William Tell refuses. Then he and his son Jemmy are brought before him. Tell is recognised as the man who helped the huntsman Leutold escape, and the price of his freedom, to shoot an apple off his son's head. And Tell does it, of course, and spectacularly. But an extra bow for his crossbone is found, and that means that was for Gessler if he missed. So he's dragged away in chains. Princess Matilda manages to appear and demand the boy. Mayhem ensues, and the soldiers turn on the people. Well, in Act 4, Arnold and the Swiss Confederates arm themselves and leave for battle. Meanwhile, as the storm gathers on Lake Lucerne, news comes that Tell has broken his fetters, and he comes back in the boat that took him to captivity. He's reunited with his wife Hedwig and his son, who's been kept safe by Matilda, and who now joins the Swiss in the fight for liberty. The hated Gessler appears on a rock, and using his father's crossbow, Tell kills him, and he plunges into the lake. A burning house signals the start of revolution. Arnold appears. He's already taken the city of Altdorf. And as the opera ends, the storm passes, the landscape and the music released in all its glory. On the lake, boats are there with their flags. Great glaciers gleam with light, and all praise land and liberty. Well, this is quite a final denouement. Sarah Lenton is with me here in the box. Actually, we haven't met the baddie yet, Gessler, have we?
He bides his time. This is such a long opera that Rossini can take his time as to when people turn up. So the heroine doesn't turn up till halfway through, and the villain comes on to set up that famous test and be killed. The important thing is to get Gessler killed.
Yeah.
So he just turns up for the last act, put his hat on the pole, sort out the apple, and get killed.
The apple, of course, is what everyone knows about William Tell is, yes, the apple. And here's the apple of everyone's eye tonight. And Tindra Papano coming back to bring us the last two acts, Act 3 and 4 of Rossini's final and glorious opera, William Tell, live from the Royal Albert Hall at the Academy of St. Cecilia in Rome.
Pour vos gémeaux pères. j'espère. Je renonce aux faveurs du sort, je renonce à tout ce que j'aime, à la gloire, à vous-même.
À moi, Melthal!
Mon père est mort, il est tombé sur l'homicide grève. Votre froid l'a nommé Gessler.
Notre amour et l'espérance, comme un père nous commence. Notre amour et l'espérance, comme un père nous commence.
Oh! soumettre à ma loi. Il doit se soumettre à ma loi. Devant ce signe de puissance, que chacun s'écroule en silence, comme il s'écline devant moi, comme il s'écline devant moi. Que chacun s'écroule en silence, que chacun s'écroule en silence, comme il s'écline devant moi, comme il s'écline devant moi. Thank you.
noblesse, avilir ce peuple. Mais moi, je ne reconnais point la loi qui m'est prescrite une bassesse.
Gouverneur, on brave ta loi.
Quel est l'audacieux?
J'ai su le reconnaître. C'est Guillaume Tell, c'est ce traître qui ravit à nos coups le col de nos meurtriers.
Saisissez-le! Saisissez-le! Thank you.
lâché par tout autre homme. Sur la tête du fils, on place cette pomme. Tu vas de très certain enlever à mes yeux. Oh, vous payerez tous les deux.
Quelle idée,
je le veux.
Quel horrible décret. Sur mon fils, je m'égare. Tu pourrais ordonner barbare. Oh, le crime est trop grand.
Au pays.
Oh, tu n'as pas d'enfant. Il est en Dieu, Gessler.
Maître,
il nous entend.
C'est trop tardé, cède sur l'âme.
Je ne le puis.
Que son fils meure.
Abominable loi, du triomphe de ma faiblesse, le péril de gémir me pose une bassesse. Gessler. Je fléchis le genou devant toi.
Voilà cet archer redoutable. Voilà cet atlétide d'automnier. La peur latère. Un mot l'accable.
Ce châtiment du moins est équitable. Tu me punis d'avoir pu m'oublier.
Mon père, songe à ton adresse.
Oh, je crains trop de ma tendresse.
Tombe ta main. Tombe ta main.
Sur ton sein. Le calme de ton cœur a raffermi ma main. Plus de faiblesse, plus d'alarme, comme rôde mes soins. Je suis
on attache son fils.
Attaché, que le jure. Non, non, livre-moi, je mourrai. J'expose au coffre, ma tête sans murmure.
Thank you.
Je regrette ma gare Oh, n'abandonne point l'espoir de la vengeance. Passionse presse le moment des je n'y rentre.
l'alarme.
Vengeance! Vengeance!
Ce sont mes compagnons, je les vois accourir.
Oh,
s'irrive par la tempête et rejetée. Ses mains cessent d'être captives, le gouvernail cède à sa volonté.
Si Guillaume, malgré l'âge, peut approcher de ce rivage, je n'ai pas de sa liberté.
Brille à mes yeux.
Une femme bûchée d'alarme, moi-même j'ai embrasé le toit de mes aïeux. Aide-moi, je t'ai sauvé des hommes.
Est-ce l'heure, tu peux venir?
Orgueilleux,
sono troveissose.
Fino a plisa formidere, al cor feta notre pistose.
Ending in a blaze of light and liberty, and in the universal key of C major, the resounding mountain call that stirs the soul of every true Swiss. Switzerland regained from the Austrian conquerors. The end of Rossini's great opera, William Tell. And I can tell you that the Academy and chorus of the Academy of St. Cecilia in Rome, and Antonio Papano and all the soloists tonight have conquered the hearts of everybody here in the Royal Albert Hall. It's been a magnificent performance, and I think quite a surprise to many of us just what delights and unexpected glories lie in Rossini's last great operatic effort. What can we say? Age 37, he never wrote another thing, but even he knew, I think, he'd gone out himself in a blaze of glory. William Tell was sung tonight by Michaela Petrucci. Hedwig, his wife, is Patricia Barden. Jemmy, the trouser role of their son, was sung by Elena Zampidakis. Marlene Bergström was Princess Matilda, who comes over to the side of right and Swiss glory and gets her man in the end, who is, of course, the high seas. The king of the high seas tonight, John Osborne, Arnold Melchior, the tenor. I think James Joyce said there were 15, and Sarah Lenton said there were. I'm prepared to believe it. His father, Melchior, was Frederick Caton. Matthew Rose was Walter Fürst. Chelsea Albela was Rudi. Leuchtturm was Mark Stone. Gessler, the bad governor, was Nicolas Pujal. Rodolphe was Carlo Bossi. And the huntsman earlier was Davide Malvestio. The orchestra and chorus of the Academy of St. Cecilia, shining as bright as they did in the days of Palestrina, I think. Antonio Papano and all his cast coming to take another bow here at the Royal Albert Hall. What a wonderful occasion it has been. And here comes the chorus master, Ciro Visco. Sensational light and shade in these ladies and gentlemen from Rome. Really, I think it's knocked us absolutely all sideways. Paolo Maria Carazzoli is the leader, is the concertmaster of the orchestra, who are now rising to their feet as well. Quite a few of them, not absolutely vast forces, nothing like the forces you'll see in the Royal Albert Hall tomorrow night. My goodness, they do inhabit this work and absolutely own it. I think the applause will go on for quite some time. So as we reach the end of this long, but certainly not seemingly long, evening of Rossini's William Tell here at the Royal Albert Hall in London, it's good night from me and back to the studio at Broadcasting House.
Sean Rafferty there at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, in a few minutes' time at 11 o'clock, we join Tom Service for Contemporary Music in Here and Now. Two first performances, Elliot Carter's Conversations and Charlotte Bray's Replay, and another piece by Charlotte Bray called Caught in Treetops. And the programme ends with Robert Saxton's A Yardstick to the Stars. So, to take us up to Here and Now, here's some music written by Herbert Howells. Music by Herbert Howells, My Lord Sandwich's Dream, played by John McCabe. Now here's Catherine Bott to tell us about another aspect of the proms.
The BBC Proms Chamber Music Series. Over the course of the proms season, from now until the 5th of September, every Monday lunchtime, Radio 3 heads to London's Cadogan Hall for chamber music of all shapes and sizes. A stellar cast of instrumentalists includes Yo-Yo Ma, Christian Tetzlaff, and Les Talents Lyriques. And our season begins with Bach's Goldberg Variations, one of the peaks of the repertoire, performed by harpsichordist Mahan Esfahani. Chamber music at the BBC Proms, live Monday lunchtimes at 1 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
And looking ahead to tomorrow afternoon, our Sunday concert is music by Vaughan Williams and Hamilton, given by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Manzi. We'll be hearing Vaughan Williams' Fantasia on a theme by Thomas Tallis and his London Symphony. And that's our Sunday concert from the City Halls in Glasgow, and that starts at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. That's here on BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's a minute past 11, time for this week's Here and Now with Tom Service.
The Aldborough and Cheltenham festivals in focus on tonight's Here and Now. Oliver Nusson conducts the Birmingham Contemporary Music Group. The Festival Academy soloists in Cheltenham give us Charlotte Bray and Robert Saxton. Back in Aldborough, there's Ligeti and Nancaro from Pierre-Laurent Aymar and Jürgen Hocker. First, though, if you've ever heard another world premiere by a 102-year-old composer, you're doing better than me. We're going to start with a new piece by Elliot Carter, born 1908. Called Conversations for solo percussionist, pianist and ensemble. Colin Curry is the percussionist, the Aldborough Festival's artistic director, Pierre-Laurent Aymar is on piano, and the Birmingham Contemporary Music Group are conducted by Oliver Nusson. Dialogue, diversion, discussion, dynamism, and all of it in 6.5 minutes. Enjoy. Thank you. Elliot Carter's Conversations, that world premiere performance from the Birmingham Contemporary Music Group, conducted by Oliver Nusson, the soloists, the Aldborough Festival's artistic director, Pierre-Laurent Aymar on piano and Colin Curry on percussion. Well, next on tonight's Here and Now, two pieces by Charlotte Bray, one from the same concert at the Snake Maltings Concert Hall and another from the Cheltenham Festival. Charlotte's with me now. Look, Charlotte, the first piece we're going to hear is Caught in Treetops, a piece you wrote last year, a violin concerto. But how important is this piece for you in your composing career?
It's perhaps hard to say at this time, actually. But I think it is. It's a very important piece to me at the moment. It came about as a result of my residency with Birmingham Contemporary Music Group. I spent a year with the group from 2009 to 2010. I studied in Birmingham before that, so I knew quite a few of the players. But it was really fantastic to get heavily involved in the group.
It's kind of an amazing story, your journey as a composer. I mean, you're not 30 yet, and you only started composing really about 7 years ago. What happened, and what were you doing before?
I went to study in Birmingham in 2001 as a cellist. I was enjoying studying cello, but I think I always knew that I wasn't a performer at heart, and I happened to compose as part of the musicianship work we had to do there. I lived with a composer at the time, and he noticed that it was quite good, and I realised how much I'd enjoyed composing that. So within a few months, I changed course and studied composition there for 3 years, mainly with Joe Cutler. And then in 2006, I went to study with Mark Anthony Turnage at the Royal College of Music.
That's a pretty amazing thing. I mean, now with commissions like this from the Birmingham Contemporary Music Group and the soloist Alexandra Woods, I mean, it's a fairly sort of meteoric rise you've had, Charlotte.
Yes.
I mean, how have you navigated yourself as a composer? Have you had to say, you know, I'm this kind of composer, I'm not like Carter, say, I'm more like Ligeti or whatever it is. How have you navigated yourself as a composer?
I think it's been quite organic throughout the process. It's been a really exciting journey, and I feel very grateful that I've met so many fantastic performers and ensembles that I've been able to work with. And through studying at the Royal College, I went on the Britain Peers course and there met Oliver Nusson and Colin Matthews.
At Aldborough, of course.
At Aldborough, exactly, yeah. So Aldborough, really, I feel like it really stems from the heart of my career in a way.
So Caught in Treetops then, a violin concerto, a single movement, about 17 minutes, but a poetic title and poetic inspiration as well, Charlotte. Where does the piece, what's the idea that the piece comes from?
Actually, Birmingham Contemporary Music Group commissioned a solo violin piece to go in one of their family's concerts last April. So I wrote that for Alexandra, and the ensemble actually improvised around it, which was a really interesting process. From that, the concerto grew out. So I had a chance to work with the musicians in quite an abstract way in the improvisation solo piece, and then form my concerto from that. It's not something I've done before, but it's been a really interesting process.
And in fact, the piece opens with an improvisatory sounding violin solo from Alexandra Wood.
Yeah. When you have a soloist on stage, I just see it as an exciting opportunity just to start with the soloist and throw them and the audience in the deep end, really. And the inspiration for that opening actually came from a piece called Autumn Nocturne by Sonny Rollins. And in this, I think it's a 5-minute improvisation, 3 minutes of it at the beginning of Sonny Rollins just going absolutely wild on the saxophone.
Yeah.
And then the ensemble comes in. And when I first heard this, it had such an impact that the ensemble didn't come in for so long. And I just wanted to try that, I guess. I should say, poetry is always important to me as a composer. Even if I'm not setting poetry for a song cycle, it seems to often find a way into the initial inspiration for the piece as well.
And so here, I mean, Caught in Treetops is Rossetti, is that right?
That's right, yeah. Actually, there's two poems. There's the Rossetti, which has a lot of energy and a real playful atmosphere to it, and that's what I took for the first movement of the piece. The second movement is really inspired by a poem by Lorca called The Moon Sails Out, and that has a much more tranquil and quite sombre mood to it.
Well, Charlotte, then let's hear Caught in Treetops, the Birmingham Contemporary Music Group at the Snake Maltings Concert, part of this year's Aldborough Festival, conducted by Oliver Nusson. The violin soloist who you hear right now is Alexandra Wood.
Thank you.
Thank you.